One secret sauce is that you also need why you're doing what you're doing. So there's like a thought cloning process that goes into this, where you kind of iterate why you're doing what you're doing. So that now what we're doing is we're taking both the human actions through Detroit and the human thought process, and then we clone that behavior as part of our AI.
Hello, everyone. I'm here with Bernd Burnich, co-founder and CEO of 1X, an AI and robotics company producing androids to benefit society and meet the world's labor demand. They recently raised over 100 million euros from EQT Ventures, Sam Altman's OpenAI Fund, and other notable global investors to bring to market its second generation android called Neo. Neo is tailored for everyday home assistants, from washing dishes, tidying up clothes, and maybe one day just maybe being a nanny, offering versatile support for a wide range of domestic tasks in the consumer market. The recent fundraise will also support 1X's existing enterprise clients in logistics and guarding. This is one of the most excited companies in Europe and stands at the forefront of AI robotics. Their mission is to create androids that work among people and have a new approach to embodied learning for data collection. During this episode, we discuss about the importance of building softness in order for androids to work and live among humans, the infinite demand curve for a useful android, and his advice for founders to go and build stuff that matters. More specifically, filling the gap for a future with energy abundant. Enjoy.
Actually, I'm back in Norway now because we are building the factory here in Norway. Most of our hardware development and also what I call like foundational software, which is basically like the firmware and controls, happening in Norway. And then we have most of our AI development happening in San Francisco. That's being headed up by Eric Zhang, who came out of Google, who's our VP of AI. Europe has had a very good hardware talent pool. And we still have, to some extent, some more manufacturing. And we build a lot of hardware devices. And then, of course, the AI community and the drive in San Francisco is something that you get sucked in, right? It's like it's a nice bubble. And right now, since we're building the factory over here, that's pretty much stuff that has to be followed up hands-on. Super important now to build our factory together with the designers who actually built the product. Make sure we're all sleeping on the line and getting this to work together. Have it as close to home as possible. So we're actually building out the factory in an extended space of our headquarters. So we're literally in the same building.
That's pretty cool.
But I mean, I spend about 30% of my time in the San Francisco area and about 70 of it over here. So quite a bit of travel.
And if we take a step back, you're building robots or androids. Do you remember the first time you start thinking about robots?
As a kid, I always loved hardware. I love things that move, right? So I was the kind of kid who would annoy my mom by like disassembling all of the kitchen equipment because it had motors in it and trying to see what I could build, usually not so successful. I built a lot of stuff with my dad. Like we would compete in these local races, building like these kind of mock-up cars that you build as a kid to race down the hill. And we did like all in on this, like welded aluminum frames and like repurposing bikes. And yeah, a lot of fun with that. So kind of grew up with that. And then when I started playing computer games, I got really into programming. And I really loved like the early game engine development and like modifying game engines and these kind of things. And I was looking at this excavator. That's like what I remember. I think I was like, just started programming, was like 11 or 12. Looking at this excavator going about his thing, excavating. And it kind of clicked. And I was like, I'm going to build humanoid robots. I still struggle with like connecting the two. Like there's no logic. Except the thing was moving. Like you get this high, right? When you see like you write some code and something happens in the physical world. This embodiment and how you can think about software being able to like rearrange the atoms of the world, right? It's like you can almost get to where you think about like the world is just another compute surface, right? For me to really be happy, I need something to move when you press play, right? But I'm very lucky to get to work with that. And like you mentioned, we build robots. And I think it's quite important to take a step back and explain a bit, like what is it actually we're building? Because robots, there's robots a lot of places and there's a lot of different robots. But for me, really, when you talk about humanoid robots, we talk about robots that are seemingly the same as us, right? So they go into our spaces, they can work in our environments without us having to adapt it. But that's just the beginning of it. There's still a lot of companies doing this these days, and there's a lot of different strategies. And
If you think about Neo, our upcoming two-legged robot, then we're very proud of the hardware. It's got the same range of motion, same type of joints as a human. It's about the average size of a human, so it's about 165 centimeters tall. It only weighs 30 kilograms, but it can actually lift 70 in like a squat or deadlift. So it's pretty much at high-end athletic performance for a human in power to weight. And the same with like joint speeds and motions, etc., right? It can run pretty much as fast as a human. Now, what actually really I feel like makes us unique is that we're not building an industrial system. So it's kind of like almost more like a Baymax. The robot itself is soft and compliant. It's strong with like very low energy when it's moving. There's no pinch points. There's no hazards. It's like very lightweight and inherently safe. And really building these systems so that they can be truly general. And to be truly general, they need to be cost efficient and they need to be safe. And I think one of the things that is the most undervalued currently is the safety aspect. Because safety doesn't only come from the software side, where we're doing a lot of interesting work. It actually comes also from the hardware. Nature is amazing, right? If you look at like animals, including humans, we are so adaptable and soft and safe. If we both are in a hurry and we go running down each of our own corridors, come around the corner and we crash, kind of awkward, might be a bit painful. Got to be really, really, really unlucky for that to be dangerous. But robots are typically these very stiff, high energy, heavy systems, and we keep them in cages. And that is not for me truly how you approach the problem of general labor. Because most of the labor that we do is physical. It's like slightly more than 50% of global GDP. And most of that labor, again, is actually not in industrial settings. It is among us in services and everything else. And this is also extremely important from an AI perspective, because what Onyx is really about is increasing the access to labor so that we can truly create an abundance of labor and through that build a society that we feel is better than what we have today. And to do this, you need to build your system so that it can actually go into the spaces that we already have. And I think if you look at the long tail of this, it's also really important to me that I want to live in a space made for me, not for a machine. I dream of a future where like, if I want my house to have only round corners, I don't have to worry about. You don't have to get rid of thresholds for your systems to do what you want to do. And in general, if you think about what is abundance of labor, if you take it to the limit, then there are so many things that we struggle with today, which just becomes a given. Like, let's, for example, think about sustainability. All products we build today that aren't done in a sustainable manner, this is because we want to save cost, because labor is expensive. So if you have an abundance of labor, there is no reason anymore to cut cost, to cut corners when building products. We can all have the products that we want, and we can all do this in a sustainable manner and in a way that like harmonizes with nature and our planet.
Do you see in the future Onyx robot being a nanny and holding a child? And I think it's a very interesting philosophical question. How do you build this softness? So one, probably it is in the material, but then second also has to be a sort of awareness of the surrounding and even maybe a little bit of lag into reaction.
It's a very good question. I'll answer the simple one first. I do think we will at some point feel comfortable with being a nanny. I do think it's still quite a bit out. So today we are able to make systems that I would argue is very, very safe for an adult. And holding a baby is something that you're a bit nervous about, even as a human, right? It's a hard problem. Yeah. There's a lot of things that need to come together. Like, that's a deep rabbit hole. Like, how do you solve that? If you think about the hardware and the softness, that is one part of it. But there's also, and I'll go a bit deeper on like how we do that. I think it's very, very interesting and very key to our approach to robotics. But there's also the work we're doing in what I would call robot foundation models for safety, which is how we humans have this incredible understanding of how the world will evolve, right? So we think about like how we have some observation and we have access to our own state. And then we know what action we're going to take. And then we can predict like what will the next observation be. So we have this perfect simulator basically of how the world will behave, given that like if we take our current state, we apply an action, how will things end up? And we use this all the time to make these like tiny risk assessments that we don't consciously think about it, but like if you try to start thinking about it, you do it all the time. Like every time you pick up something, you're like looking around and you're thinking about the consequences of what you're doing. Because no matter how safe a robot is, it's not safe once it picks up a kettle of boiling water, right? So you need to get to where you have such a good understanding of the role and common sense that you can actually make very good risk assessments, in addition to making sure your hardware is as safe, adaptable, and compliant as possible. So if you think about the hardware aspect of it, then it's very much like reasoning by first principles. If you look at nature, there is an animal I know of above water. Interestingly enough, there is an underneath water, above water, that has what we call positive mechanical advantages or gear ratios. So what I mean by that is, if you think about like your elbow joint moving as you move your arm, there is nothing inside your elbow that moves faster than your elbow itself. Now, in a typical robot, there would be a gear here, and there would be a motor spinning at least 100 times faster than your elbow inside. And the very simple secret here is kinetic energy is the square of that velocity. So this is why anything that moves very fast, no matter its weight, is very dangerous. And the amount of energy in the system when it moves for classical robots is what makes them stiff and dangerous, and what makes them basically either destroy itself or whatever it's touching if it has uncontrolled collisions. But that's not how nature works at all. We take these incredible efficiency hits just to not have these advantages, because then we can be soft, compliant, very low energy, and said in like a simpler way, we can let the world dictate how we should move. And you see this very much in the robotics field. If you look at, for example, YouTube of robots trying to open doors, and a robot thinking that I am going to win versus the door. But the door is going to move the way the hinges of the door has decided that the door is going to move. If you try to move it any other way, you are going to lose. And that's not how we humans work, right? Because we adapt, we are soft, we are compliant, and we conform to the environment. And this has to be built into the hardware. This is part of the biomechanics of how we move. And that's why for 1X, it really for me started in that end. It started with how can we replicate these beautiful dynamics that we see in nature. And that is done through, at this point, our own motor system, where we're pulling on tendons, which are very loosely inspired by human muscle, and where we can have these same low energy systems still be strong and able to do things, so we can move in this natural and dynamical way. That makes the system itself very safe. But then again, as I said, right, how are you safe once you start doing useful work? And that is a much deeper problem. And it touches on the embodiment of AI and how we can get systems that have common sense for reasoning about the physical world. And that's, I think, some of the things that I'm the most excited about in the coming year is the results that we're starting to see once we're now scaling the fleet size and we're starting to have access to a lot of data compared to what has ever been before in these kind of robotics, because it's been mostly academic lab experiments. Seeing that, or to some extent for a lot of things, see even better scaling laws than what you saw for early large language models, because the data is so rich. If your goal is basically to build a simulator of the world, which is what in AI we call a world model, and like a large language model is a special case of this, where you know how to basically simulate forward which sentences should follow, and then you can feed these back as the input and predict more sentences. If you want to have like the ultimate world model, then actually having access to the state and the action that you're taking, and like having that embodiment that allows you to ground your role model, makes it a lot better. But there's not too many results here yet, right? Because it's very early days of this. But you see this typically as like, if you look at OpenAI Sora, for example, it still struggles a lot with basic things like object permanency, like something goes behind something and now it's gone, or it struggles a lot with physics. It doesn't necessarily know the affordances of interactions between objects. And there's even some first principles thinking here too, where a lot of the things that happens with dynamics and physics is actually not observable in video. So you need some kind of embodiment to have firsthand access to that state.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, because if you truly want to have to represent the world, probably you have to include somehow the observer as well, and the experience of the observer, not only simulate the world, whereas like I think you can have it like through a robot. And then you can have like all this data on how the world behaves, and then also the observation from the robot, but then across a fleet, and then you have like almost like this collective intelligence coming from a fleet of robots that can gradually improve based on how they experience the world.
And even more interestingly, right, you can look at where are you not performing well, and you can actually query your fleet for more data. That flywheel play, right?
Yeah.
So let's say that we are struggling with how humans or agents, as we call them in our AI, like how do they actually move so that we can navigate social situations in an efficient manner. This is actually a very interesting problem that we've been working on a lot. Then let's pull more data for that. And, you know, then we get into another very interesting subject that's talked a lot about these days when it comes to AI, which is alignment. Because in social situations, if you are a droid and you're going to navigate a crowd, at least for now, because we're not so used to the droids yet, right? Your most efficient strategy and like your emergent ability for how to achieve this goal as efficiently as possible is actually to just move at pretty high speed straightforward, because that will like make people maximally afraid and they will move. But this is not the behavior you want your droid to do. So you need to prune your data, right? And you need to ensure that like, okay, the behavior that we want here should be aligned with how we want the droids to follow our social norms for how do you behave well, right? You don't want a rude robot. No. You want a nice robot.
It's pretty fascinating because like some people kind of start with a problem. We want the robot to do this task, and then softness and awareness would come second, whereas like you kind of started with the biomechanics. How can you build this awareness and the softness? And then let's look at the tasks. Tell me a little bit about how do you see the world's labor demand, and maybe what are the first use cases that you're deploying your fleet? And if you can, and if you wanted to tell us a little bit about how big is the fleet, how do you see the production, how do you want to increase that? What are the next use cases that you want to tackle and why?
Sure. So I think, and here we have pretty much a very contrarian bet. Let me actually take you back to the early days of large language models. I think there's a lot of lessons learned here. There was a lot of companies who tried to build specialized models. So they would say, we're going to build the world's best language model for writing novels. So we're going to put a lot of time into curating the best possible data set of like high quality novels, and we're going to train on that. Now, what actually won was the ones who said, we're just going to train on everything, and then we're going to fine tune a bit on novels, if that's our use case. And then hindsight, maybe not so surprising, that works a lot better, because most of our creativity and our common sense especially comes from the diversity of our data, like the long tail of tasks you have seen. But that was not obvious to begin with, but now it pretty much is. Robotics is no different. If you want to be incredibly good at packing shoes in a box, you should probably have done as diverse a set of tasks as possible, living in human spaces, together with humans, observing everything that can go wrong in the world, and how we try to mitigate these risks and operate in an efficient manner, and you will be better at packing shoes in a box. So I actually don't believe in the narrow, let's solve one specific use case first. That works if you don't need common sense and general intelligence. But that's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to solve intelligence through embodiment. And that diversity is the secret ingredient. It's not so secret really, but it's hard to do in the real world, right? Because this means you actually have to deploy into a very wide, diverse set of domains. And that puts some constraints on your system. Like, first of all, it needs to be safe, like we've already talked about. Second of all, it needs to be quite cost efficient. And there is a lot of, I don't know if I would use the word hype, because if we pull this off, it is going to completely change the way we look at labor. It's probably going to be a bigger change to how humanity operates than the agricultural revolution. So it's kind of like hard to call it a hype from like a classical Silicon Valley hype bubble. Mm-hmm. If someone succeeds, I do hope and think it's going to be us, but time will tell. But what isn't talked enough about is that years ago, we could actually build very good humanoid robots. Like the Honda Asimo P6 is more than 20 years old, and that could run up and down stairs, go over and give you a bottle of water. So why did it fail, right? Mm. And why do we think if we just build a similar system now, it'll work? And we already touched upon it, that it has to do a lot with like the dynamics of how we move and the energy in these systems, like stiff versus more modern bio-inspired robotics. And then, of course, on the AI side, there's a lot that we are able to do today that we could not even dream of doing back in the 90s. But I think what people underestimate is you need to be able to scale this. And if your system costs hundreds of thousands, or in most cases now actually millions of dollars, there is no way you are going to scale this. And a lot of these systems, like the lower bound of cost is still pretty high because of the technical choices being made. So no matter how much volume you have, they're still going to be very expensive. And this does limit you to some very set specific use cases. And I think this is the main driving force behind why you see people betting so heavily on very specific high margin tasks in the beginning. It's not because those make sense, because what actually makes sense is to get diversity. It is because if you want to scale this and like push thousands and then hundreds of thousands and millions of droids out there the next few years, you actually need to scale manufacturing and you need to have a scalable cost on your hardware. And that's something we really thought about from day one. So like every technical decision we've made from 9 years ago and up till now has been, how do we do this so that we can manufacture this at scale with as close to basically material cost as possible? And even to the point of like, how do you get material cost down? And this, of course, has been very painful because this means we've at this point made absolutely everything ourselves. We literally have copper coming into the building together with aluminium. And then we start winding copper and compressing coils and doing high accuracy motors and the drivetrains. Like we pull our own ropes and terminate them for the tendons. Like it's completely vertically integrated, almost back to like Foreman River Run type days. But makes us able to manufacture in a very affordable manner because most of the components that we had aren't really made for this product because the product doesn't exist yet. So like I usually say, if I was to start a electric car company today, I would most likely build the powertrain and battery stuff myself, some controllers and software. Like the car industry is still lagging a bit behind on software. The rest of the parts I'd actually just buy, right? Get some good quotes with OEMs because there's absolutely no reason to do that yourself. This is not true for human or robots because there are no components that exist that are meant for this specific form factor. So when you try to cobble this together from off-the-shelf parts, it becomes incredibly clunky and incredibly expensive. And that has been done before. And it gets you pretty far, but it doesn't really get you out of the lab. But it is a real catch-22 because if you don't get, I'd say like at least 1,000, might be 10,000. We don't have like 100% confidence in our scaling laws yet, but somewhere around there, that's the number of droids you need deployed to get to where you have these emergent common sense capabilities from your AI models. And looping it back to your question about markets, that's why we are actually going both top down and bottom. So Neo will be used by, like I'd call it prosumer, like high-end consumer. It'll be used by mom and pop shops. It'll be used in manufacturing. We, of course, use it in manufacturing ourselves. It'll be used in logistics. It'll be used in services. It'll clearly be used in guarding large enterprise buildings. That's something we're already doing today with our previous generation droid. And for me, it's all about creating availability and creating the tools that enables our customers, together with our operators over here, to automate the things that you care about. Think about it like when you get a droid at home, right? The first thing that meets you is like, congratulations on your droid. I'm here to help you automate whatever you would like to automate and helping you basically get the product to a state where it is now doing the tasks that you don't want to do. And this is a very personal thing because I want my home in a specific manner. You probably want your home in a slightly different manner. And this is not something that we can kind of figure out in advance, right? This is something that you need to teach the robot.
Isn't that though harder to sell? So I'm only thinking from the prism right now in the market, people are just so used. It was like, oh, this is a product and it does X. So then I'm buying it. Let's take Roomba, for example, which is like it cleans your apartment. I was like, okay, I'm buying it. So usually the purchase that we make is to solve a problem. Whereas like, I definitely see how theoretically you would want 1,000 or 10,000 droids learning from being programmed. But then how do you make the deal? How do you convince, you know, the construction companies, the manufacturing, like, do you actually in the sales process, you have some time where you kind of explore how they can use it?
Sure. It really depends on which part of the market. So for the construction work or for like in general, the enterprises, right? Then what we do is that we help them teach the droids what to do. Part of the service. Think about it like a robot integrator, right? If you buy a robot, you have an integration service, except here there's no software. Everything is just data. And I think that's maybe one of our biggest wins this year, that we've moved to this completely end-to-end system now, where it's just robot takes observations in, it outputs actions, it's just based on the data. And it works incredibly well. And what this enables us to do is to take people who don't have any competence in AI and enable them to get the robot to do almost anything. And then building out those tools so they're as easy to use as possible. So most of the data that gets gathered on our fleet now through what we call like the expert demonstrations, where you put on a VR headset and we map your body to the droid's body and you see through the droid's eyes and you do labor as if you were there. That is done by our people that we just train for that. And then they add data to the fleet and they train the AI and they do this every day, right? For a lot of hours. It's all they do. So at this point, interestingly enough, they're actually better than the AI team at getting the model to do what it needs to do. And this is kind of like taking a bit out of the playbook of Stable Diffusion, right? Where there's this huge community of people fine-tuning the model to whatever they want to use it for. And some of those fine-tuned models are just like way better than the original model because they sunk so much time into it. But this, just going about like how this works in construction, this is actually incredibly powerful because what it means is if you want to do something as a test, we ship you the droids and we do the tasks. And we do them with an operator, not AI, right? In the beginning, first few days. But it's at that point borderline trivial to figure out if we can do the tasks because we just do them. It's very low cost. And if we can do them, then the AI can do it. So that's just a question of gathering the data. So that process is actually pretty smooth. I think the harder process is towards consumer, where you don't really want to have this open-ended product that you have to figure out how to use, just like you mentioned with your robot. You want to have something that's kind of like neatly packaged up and just like does what it's supposed to do. Mm. At the same time, you do want it to put like your dishes in the cabinet where you want them. And you, like you know how things should be organized in your home. And this is a bit of a harder mix. And I wouldn't say we've solved it yet. We've taken some good steps. We are just at the beginning of deploying this. And there are some of these like core things that just like put my house back into the state that it was, which is pretty straightforward. They're very hard from a robotics perspective, but it is pretty straightforward from like a product integration perspective. Now, how do you want your droid to behave in general around like you, your family, social situations, friends? That is a lot harder. And there we're still experimenting with what to do. But what seems to work pretty well is to almost seamlessly like interleave these operators with AI so that you can say that you get a leverage on your human efficiency. So one operator oversees a lot of robots because when they need help, because they're struggling with a specific task they're not good enough at yet, then you take over, help the robot do the task, and then you log off again. And then it's all about how do you structure this in a privacy-aware manner? And that's something we care deeply about and think a lot about these days. It's like, how do we ensure that we have all the data we need so that we can make a very good product for you, but that we don't have data that is unnecessary from a privacy point of view, and that we minimize the people who see your data, and that you feel in control of your data and all of these things. It's really the big brother versus big sister, right?
Can I add something just to make sure that I understand? So like how the operator works, because I think this is kind of fascinating. So let's take the construction and then we can move to the consumer example. So in construction, let's say someone lifts something or puts some sort of brick on a wall. And if you say, if the operator can do it, then the robot can learn how the operator does it, and then the robot can do it. How does this learning transfer from the operator to the robot?
So when the operator does this task, it is very important to realize that the robot does the task together with the operator. So you kind of teleport your body into the robot. And then if we do a good job, you almost feel like you're there. You should feel like it's your own arms, your own hands. And then you do the task just as if you were there. And here's where it becomes incredibly important that our hardware mimics everything that is to be a human from a biomechanical point of view, so that this matches one-to-one. Now, given that you get this right, then you just go about the task as if you were there. One secret sauce is that you also need why you're doing what you're doing. So there's like a thought cloning process that goes into this, where you kind of iterate why you're doing what you're doing. So that now what we're doing is we're taking both the human actions through the droid and the human thought process, and then we clone that behavior as part of our AI.
Fascinating.
Given that you have enough of this data with a diverse enough set of tasks again, then your system will start to learn, what is the task I'm doing? Why am I doing it? Why am I doing it the way I'm doing it? Instead of just replicating your motions. So in the beginning, if you do this for a small set of data, you'll just have a robot that basically replays your motions. But if you get enough data, it'll start to actually see the bigger trend of what are the abstractions that we call tasks and how do we reason to complete these tasks in a sensible manner. And which again is very similar to the large language models, right? Where this does not work. Actually, it's not that it works worse. It does not work on small amounts of data.
because at that point, you're just basically spitting out whatever was given in. You need to get to where you're learning the trends of your data, not the data itself.
And what would be the example of a thought? Would the thought, so the thought cloning would be, I'm putting the dishes because having a tidy house, that we like to have a tidy house, and this is begin state, or this is how the state of a tidy house looks like. Hence, if the robot can learn the importance of a tidy house, it can extrapolate that not only the dishes, but whatever they might do, will be, oh, if we have some clothes on the floor, it's not a tidy house. Is that, or like, what is this thought cloning to understand why they are doing it? Can you give me an example?
Sure. It's very important that this is layered. So you have very high level concepts almost, right? Like, I'm going to clean the kitchen. And then you have more details, like going to put the cups over there on the tray so I can more efficiently carry all of them at the same time to the kitchen. Then you have, I'm picking up the cup, I'm putting the cup on the tray, I'm picking up the next cup, I'm putting the cup on the tray, right? There's no more cups on the counter, I'm carrying the tray to the kitchen. Like, you put the cup in the dishwasher. You can say, like, I put the cup in the top drawer in the dishwasher where cups usually go. And somewhere in your data set, there's a like, this dishwasher actually has cups in the bottom. I'll put it in the bottom, right? Again, the diversity of your data. Because the point here isn't to learn that you put cups in the top of the dishwasher. The point here is to learn why you put cups in the top of the dishwasher and when do you not. So this is not so far away from how thought processes and like how we write our language gets clothed into language models. But what is very unique is that it is coupled to actual observations, states, and actions. And especially that you have the actions. You have access to the actions that resulted in the next step of observations. And that is just a lot more sample efficient. Like, you could learn this probably from just enough data. I mean, visual language models could still reason about color. But I mean, the amount of data you need to learn about colors from text is quite large. It's basically just this modality is not the right modality. It's very inefficient. You would rather just learn from a few pictures. The same is true for all modalities, right? Trying to learn audio from language is hard because, let's say, you want to know who's talking to you and you don't have this egocentric audio data to help you figure that out. Now, maybe if you have enough language, you can understand this from the context, but it's very inefficient. And the same goes for figuring out like the affordances, agent behavior, friction, physics, everything that has to do with how the world evolves. If you have enough video, maybe you can do it, but it's extremely sample inefficient. So given that everyone runs out of compute and everyone runs out of tokens to train on, I'm pretty bullish on the bet being sample efficiency and compute efficiency. And this is where embodiment helps you a lot.
And how do you see the adoption cycle? What's the plan for the next 5 years?
Sure. So currently, what we have out in the field is Eves, which is the previous generation that has wheels, but it is a very capable Android. So it has like the full range of motion of like human arms and the torso. The leg is actually the same as a human leg. It's just, think about like a human standing on a Segway. So this is the one that's deployed today. And Neo is, well, like I said, we are building factory right now. And it won't be that far. And it's not that long until we will come with some official dates on when this will be available. So we've built in total 70 EVEs. And a lot of them are deployed. I can't give you the exact numbers. And some of them are for internal use. And these might seem like small numbers, right? But I don't know of any other company that has 70 actual humanoids with like full manipulation ability and balancing and everything out there doing tasks every day. So it actually generates pretty steep amount of data. Now, it's still very small compared to once the Neo factory goes online. We will at least be, in the coming year-ish, start to move into the thousands. You know, it's the tens. We're approaching 100. Then we go to thousands. So when you say 5 years, I think it's incredibly interesting. Because if you asked me 2 years ago, I would have been a lot more conservative. And usually it's all the way around, right? Things take longer, not shorter, development-wise. Right now, I think we have a pretty good bet at getting to something that would pass the Wozniak test, if you're familiar with that one, which is go into any house and make a cup of coffee in the coming years. I could say, if you want to like have some more hype to it, that
in the next few years, we have a pretty good shot at solving intelligence through embodiment and getting to AGI. But then it's very important to define what do I mean by that, right? There are so many different opinions on what is AGI. So for me, that means a system that is able to do most labor that humans can do, and that has enough common sense to be able to recover from failures. And pretty sure that if there's no big barriers we don't know about, in 5 years, we will be there. We will be there before 5 years by a solid margin. Now, what we should not forget is that this is not software. It's actual hardware. So the question of how many droids will be out there in 5 years, I think it's actually more a question of manufacturing than AI capabilities. Because long before you have something as useful as what I'm describing now, you will have close to infinite demand. Once you have something that is cost efficient, it does more labor per dollar than what you have access to today. There's a huge labor shortage today, right? It's not only about cost. Then it is essentially just how many can you produce? But that is a hard problem. And I think if we are able to scale this in a very, very good manner, then in 5 years, we will be talking millions. But I think that the demand will be billions, but and we will scale as fast as we can. If we get to 1 million droids in 5 years, I would be very happy. That's my definition of success.
Awesome.
I don't think it's a problem to sell 10 million as long as they work. The cost efficiency of labor with the droids is incredible. It's just, it's a very complicated system and it has never been built before at scale. So it's quite an operation to scale from tens of units to millions of units, right? That has to be done at a certain ramp rate for you to be able to pick off things that suddenly show up. Once you start to get towards millions of droids, right? Then you're at like more of like statistics on your line than testing and yield. There's a lot that needs to be developed for that to work at that scale. But I do think that's doable. I'd like to speed run it and get to like 10 and 100 million in 5 years. But the goal is millions.
When can I buy one? Neither my girlfriend or I like to do the dishes or laundry. Where can I buy one or pre-order, and what's the price?
So I cannot tell you yet, but I'll tell you it's pretty soon. And I think you will be pleasantly surprised about the cost. It is actually something that I would easily defend the cost of, given that it does what it's supposed to do. And I think that's the big task that's ahead of us now, as we start to roll this out first to some very early friends and family, and start not only dog feeding it internally in the company, but actually also with external customers. It is proving out that it's not a gimmick. The home is full of consumer gimmick products, right? That seemed so cool. Like, oh, so sweet, I want this. And then it's collecting dust in a corner. So important for me that this is actually something that will be seen as an essential part of your household, or we have failed. And we're not quite there yet. I think we're getting close, but we're not quite there yet. And we need to get there before we actually deploy the product.
I just talked with an investor the other day, and then he asked me, are you going to build your business in Norway? There are not a lot of people hustling there. What do you make of it?
We hustle pretty hard.
Yeah, so I wanted to say, what do you make of that? And I wanted to say, given that you're building such a transformational company, you're competing with Tesla, you're competing with Figure, so now you're competing on talent. How do you see the competition of talent here in Norway in particular?
We are very much an international company, and it's been from day one. I mean, we are more than 100 people now, but I remember last time I counted was when we were 17 people and we had 11 nationalities. So I don't really see us as a Norwegian company. We have a pretty big base in Norway. We have a pretty big base in the US, in California, and we have a pretty significant operation in Dallas. So to me, it's all about where can you attract the best talent and the most diverse talent and put them in a place where we can really, really be efficient and thrive. And Norway has been great for this because we are actually able to relocate from almost any country in the world and in a very timely manner. So we have a great headquarters where I'm sitting here now, down by the river, by the sea. It's beautiful scenery for the campus. It's pretty close to the capital, which is hard to do in any other country, cost efficiently, where we have the definition of vertical integration, right? Machines converting everything from raw metals into droids. It is kind of like a small bubble of an ecosystem. Right. And where that is located, I don't think it matters that much. But I think it really matters from the perspective of what's the governing policies for where you operate. And Norway has been very, very good in that regard. And the ability to really don't think about where you're from, purely what's your knowledge? What can you contribute with? That's been very key to our success. Now, the US has an incredible talent pool when it comes to AI. It has a lot of capital and a lot of smart people that knows how to deploy and use capital with respect to scaling. And that is also needed. Dallas has a lot of knowledge in manufacturing and still has some extent people who know how to do manufacturing at scale, know how to run a machine shop, know how to build good tools and fixtures. This is very important. So it's really about like where is the talent currently located and how can you move it if needed.